Hi, everybody. I'm Mike Cuthbert. Welcome to Primetime Radio. Legendary status in broadcasting is pretty hard to achieve in these days of high-tech radio and depersonalized stations, but our guest this week deserves the status, perhaps because he's a veteran of the golden age of radio, when radio was all over the air as well as a survivor into the digital age. It's odd, however, that our guest was best known as a newscaster, but ended his career on a quiz show. Carl Castle has been feted and saluted since his announced retirement, a word he hates, last winter, but really hung up his headphones only a few weeks ago with his last broadcast as official judge and scorekeeper of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. It's not as if Carl waited to do that job until his career was reaching his end. He started Wait, Wait back in 1998. He joins us in our studios here in Washington to reminisce about the good old days and the new days. Or maybe they're all good. Hi, Carl.
Hi, Mike. Yeah, the days have been good, really.
Yeah?
Been a good career.
NPR's a good place to work.
It's a wonderful place. And I was very lucky because from the very beginning, when my parents had a big old console radio sitting in the corner of the living room.
Have a green eye?
Or a green eye. And you could put flowers behind it, you know. I would sometimes hide behind the radio myself when people would walk by and pretend I was on the radio and that sort of thing. And it's what I've always wanted to do. And I got lucky, and I went to college, worked with the University of North Carolina radio department and stations along the way, wound up with NPR, and I still do things from time to time at NPR.
And you still do the answering machine bit?
I do that, yes.
Who makes up the lines for you to use?
We let the winners write their own message.
And as long that could get pretty weird.
They are. Some of them are. But if that's what they want, that's what they get. They win it. They won the prize.
Exactly. Tell us more about that Victrola in Goldsboro and its role in developing the radio man, because I think every radio man has in his background a beginning story like that. Mine was baseball in the living room. I created a little baseball game that I would play and pretend I was each player and do the play-by-play.
I would hide behind that radio that we had. It was big enough for me to hide behind.
Yeah.
little fella I was. And people walked by and I would say, this is WGBR Goldsboro, North Carolina. You know, that sort of thing I hear on the radio. It got to the point that my dad said, that's enough. So he went downtown and bought a little portable radio, kind of a portable, but you had to plug it in. A small one he'd put in my bedroom so I could listen to the radio at night, any time of the day. But not all the time.
Yeah, but you couldn't be on that, could you?
No. Couldn't do that. But I could listen. I learned a lot on how to do radio programs. And I was very lucky along the way because in high school, and even before high school, I was with our drama department back in my hometown of Goldsboro, North Carolina. I'll stick that in there. I was very active with a teacher by the name of Andy Griffith, who was also one of our teachers, and learned a lot from that guy. I really did. And one summer, you see, on the Outer Banks of North Carolina, on Roanoke Island, each year, and I guess they still do, there's an outdoor theater, and they do a play called The Lost Colony in there.
Hmm.
Has to do with the first English settlement in the New World. By golly, I got a part in that play one year. Because of my activity in the high school drama department,
yeah.
I could project my voice. I learned how to be heard on the back row,
yeah.
In other words.
Your deaf aunt in the back row.
Oh, exactly. And I had a lot of fun because there was a guy, one of my teachers, a guy by the name of Andy Griffith, who was Sir Walter Raleigh. I learned a lot from that guy and his wife, Barbara. And it was a good summer for me. I was one of the two Indian chiefs of the day on Roanoke Island, Chief Juan Cheese and Chief Mateo. Today, there are two towns named Mateo and Juan Cheese along the Outer Banks. I was Chief Juan Cheese at one time. And that meant day by day.
I can see it in your carriage and your mien.
Oh, yeah. Anyhow, that meant every night before the show or late afternoon, you had to put on your makeup, and that meant full body paint. You get the tone of the Indians back in those days, and I put that stuff on. And then you could also take some color and paint here and a little bit there.
Yeah.
A little bit of...
Would you become more exotic by the end of the summer?
More or less. I remember standing off stage before being introduced to the Queen, one of her new subjects. There were two of us, by the way, Matteo and Juan Cheese. I was Chief Juan Cheese. Andy Griffith looked down at me and said, Carl? I said, yeah. He said, you went wild with that paint, didn't you? I said, I did. He said, a little bit too much paint. I'll show you how to do it next week. He was turned out to be a darn good friend, he and his wife Barbara, but he turned out to be a darn good teacher, too.
Not a bad actor, either.
Not a bad actor, no.
What was your first microphone? Mine was a wooden spoon. It was one of those round jobs and with a handle on it?
No, I got a job at the local radio station.
Oh, a real one.
I got a real job. I was very active in our high school drama department, and they knew then what I wanted to do. So the local radio station had a little audition for somebody to do high school news on the weekend. I auditioned. I got the job. And from that, after a few weeks of doing that, they offered me a job in which they paid me. You're paying me to do what I want to do and have fun with all the time? Yes, you're going to get paid. I forgot how much it was. Well, it wasn't a heck of a lot, but it was payment. And by then, my career had taken off. And pretty soon, I went to college and went to the University of North Carolina. And back in those days, they gave you, I forgot how many years, to finish your college career before you got drafted into the Army. And I was a little behind on the time that I needed, and I got drafted into the Army. As I went to the university president, I says, what do I do? He says, Carl, not a thing I can do to help you here, buddy. Go on, do your job, come on back. We'll have a job for you. And I did. So I'm a lucky guy in a lot of respects, little bumps along the road, but radio has been a great friend of me for many, many years.
Carl Castle is our guest from NPR, both Morning Edition for some 30 years and Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me for a bunch more, which he doubled up. That must have been a nice routine on the weekends to get to Chicago or wherever the show was being broadcast from and do that and then hustle back.
Oh, yeah. I'd catch a flight to Chicago on Thursday morning, do the show Thursday night, get a flight the next morning back home. Big deal. And it was so much fun. The program is still on the air, but working with a guy like Peter Sagal, who is not only witty, but he is a darn good writer, too, and turned out to be a darn good friend. I miss being on the show, and I miss Peter a lot. But working with him and other people who came and went with it, like Tom Baudette, Paula Poundstone, a lot of funny people have been on that show and still are.
Including some members of the audience. Frequently.
Oh, yes. They bring them up, too.
I want to go back to the high school and after days. You were probably, like most of us who started radio in high school, a DJ and a newsman. You ripped and read?
Exactly.
How did you learn editing from that process?
I had a good teacher. The station manager, Vassie Balcom, is the guy who hired me. And he was aware of what I could do by listening to weekend radio programs from the high school. They gave us a few minutes each weekend to do things like that. And he was impressed by what I could do. And so he taught me a lot about how to not only pick music. I often found it very interesting and a lot of fun to be there reading a commercial in front of you, at the same time reaching over, taking a record off the turntable, putting a new one on, queuing it up while you're still reading.
Yeah.
You got two or three things going at the same time, but you learn. It's good because it does teach you some concentration on what you're doing, I think.
It certainly does, especially when what you're going to play next is cut 4 out of 12 on the side of,
exactly,
of an LP. A lot of kids who are listening to us now don't even know what you're talking about. Queuing up a record?
Queuing up a record.
And another thing that's even more revolutionary is you said how to select music as if you had a choice.
We did back then.
Not now.
For one thing, the station manager always made sure that the music which was there for us to play was the music that he wanted to hear. If there was some stuff he didn't want to be on the air, we wouldn't have it in front
of
us.
What format did you have?
Popular music.
Yeah. Middle of the road?
Yeah, more or less. I mean, we had a little guy who came through from time to time. with a, you know, he says, I'm a new record guy, and I just made a few records, and I brought one by, and I thought maybe if you play it for me once in a while, some people might like it and buy it. He passed through several times, and by golly, one day Elvis Presley became what Elvis Presley became. And I remember what happened, and he did come by and passed off his records, and he would perform at movie houses in the state between showings of a film. Yeah. He'd get out and sing a song or so. That was all right. He's got a nice voice and so forth. He's doing pretty well. But then one night, one of the musics that they played between showings of the film was a kind of had a bounce to it. And that's when Elvis began to shake his hips along with the song. His career took off right there.
All based on the pelvis, for heaven's sake. What sent you into news full time?
Oh, that's kind of hard to
WAVA, was it?
AVA, I guess so, yeah. Mm-hmm. They put me before a microphone and said, you're going to read the news today. So I did, and pretty soon I was reading the news almost every day.
Did you have to write it too, or was that?
No, it was a rip and read.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. When I say that, rip it off the wires, take it in the studio and read it. I didn't get to write the news. Basically, what you would be doing back then would be just take what you got off the wires, look at it, read it, and then put it on paper in your own words.
Yeah.
Same thing. That's what you're doing. So that came along later. So,
what to you were the main differences between commercial broadcasting and non-commercial?
The commercials.
Yeah.
they always got in the way.
Well, how was the news affected?
Well, you given on your log, top of the hour, you're going to do 5 minutes of news. So you go to the teletype, rip off what's there, and usually it's typed in a way that it's in a brief summary, just designed for broadcasters. Take it to the studio, and when it's news time, read the news. Did that a lot. As far as writing it is concerned, very seldom that I ever sit down and write a newscast. It was a case of rip and read, they called back.
Even for non-commercial, then?
Even for non-commercial,
1975, NPR and Carl Kasell meet. He's not only non-commercial now, but he's also in many ways countercultural in 1975 public radio. How did you adjust? Or were you of the right age to just slide in there?
I guess I just slid in there. You know, when you're doing something that you like, doesn't matter where it is or how it's going to be done, you adapt yourself to the situation, to the station, and what they do. You may be playing rock music, you may be playing another type of music, country music, or you may be just doing news. You adapt yourself very quickly to it. And I think I adapted myself to many things through the years like that.
Did you start to do any specials then?
No, no specials.
Even at NPR?
No. Hmm. This is before NPR, really.
Oh, okay.
At NPR, we just jumped in and did whatever they wanted me to do.
Did you get to anchor coverage, too, for big events?
Very seldom. They always had somebody else who had a little bit more experience than me. Then I got to NPR, and, of course, how did this thing happen? I was at a function one time, and I was asked to introduce a bunch of NPR people there, and I did. Then somebody in the back said, but you didn't tell us about yourself. I said, well, what do you want to know about yourself? Well, about myself. What do you want to know? Well, what do you do? I work at NPR. I'm on the air. Yeah. And I'm trying to remember this joke now. but I got questions thrown at me about what do you do this? And you get up early in the morning to do newscasts. Yeah. What time do you get up? Oh, I get up around 5 minutes after 1 o'clock. Five after one. Why don't you get up at 1 o'clock? It's because I like to sleep late. That joke got me on Wait, Don't Tell Me.
No kidding. Our guest is Carl Kasell of NPR. He's doing fewer things now, but equally well as he's done for years and years on NPR. I'm Mike Cuthbert in Washington. You're listening to Prime Time Radio. The last of the baby boomers turns 50 this year, and a celebration AARP has opened a new webpage called Boomers at 50 Plus. It's a special section of the AARP website consisting of a calendar of boomer-oriented events, significant birthdays, and events over the years that you might want to re-celebrate. Go to aarp.org/boomers for more information. Keep in touch with us by email at primetime@aarp.org or reach us by Twitter, #AARP, or Facebook, facebook.com/AARP. This is Prime Time Radio. Carl Castle is our guest from NPR, both Morning Edition for some 30 years and Wait, Don't Tell Me for a bunch more. I understand you had an obstreperous intern when you were early on at NPR, whose career took off a little bit later. I suppose it would be justified for you to take entire credit for her. Katie Couric?
Oh, Katie, yes. Katie, I was working at a station in Arlington, Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was an all-news station. And I got a note one day from the station manager. So we have a friend in the family whose daughter is studying journalism.
I always knew it was connections.
And is looking for an internship maybe this summer at some station so she can get some experience. Don't worry about paying her. You don't have to pay a dime. If you want her, fine. If you don't, forget all about it. But here's her phone number if you're interested. So I called up Katie Couric, and Katie came in. Boy, she dynamite.
Yeah.
What a bundle of energy that woman was, and she still is. Yeah. We saw Katie a couple weeks ago in New York. Katie has done very well. I know a few times after that she'd come to me and say, Carl, why didn't you hire me? Thought about NPR. Well, I had no authority to hire anybody.
Yeah.
Katie, I didn't have the authority to hire even me if I wanted another job. But she's a very sweet gal. I love Katie, and she's a good friend.
How did you fit in at NPR after all those years at the commercial radio? Was it difficult?
No, not a bit. I found out that from place to place, you just go ahead and fit in.
Just whatever.
Whatever. Most radio stations are that then you could do.
Yeah.
No problem.
That's true.
Mm-hmm.
It's gotten more difficult, particularly with the niche broadcasting. It's commercial now.
Even a guy like Elvis Presley fit in.
Yeah.
Hey, man, I appreciate if you play my record.
As you look about you at radio today, what to you are the most significant changes other than the digitalization of it all?
Well, I think we approach the industry probably in a different way. Don't ask me what way, but it feels different. And we can go on the road a lot more than we did at the beginning, like take Wait anywhere in the country and play for an audience. Technically, we can more or less provide miracles, which we couldn't do back at the beginning, in putting together a broadcast from anywhere in the globe, so to speak. And we have a lot of good people on the air, too. I think we have improved that tremendously along the way. Young people have gotten into the industry with a desire to really make a mark in broadcasting, and they've done a good job at it.
One thing that I've noticed and I just got in on the end of it before I got into music, teaching, and then back into radio later, is the instantaneous communication with reporters and how that's changed the news business. Not only instantaneous, but high quality. In fact, with ISDN lines, it can sound as if they may be in Paris, but they could be sitting next to you. How did you react to that, and how did you feel as you began to fit more of that in the radio broadcast?
Wonderful. Boy, back in the old days, a story breaks, and maybe it's on the wire, the teletype coming in, maybe it's there. And if you can get some audio on it later on, you're lucky if you can do it. Now it's there, period. Audio on the wires, instantaneous, coming in from Europe, anywhere in the world. We've come a long, long way.
We certainly have. Even the news delivery on the wire systems is different now with computers.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
You can almost edit on the fly.
You can.
What are some of the weirdest requests you've had for phone answering machine messages? I assume there have been some strange other than just say, hi, you've reached Katie, I'm not here.
Yeah, there have been some. Things like, would you mind singing a song for me? A song? Uh-huh. And they write the words down there. Oh, I know that song. What's new, pussycat? What's new, pussycat? And leave a message after the beep.
Yeah, that's it.
Something similar to that today. Yeah, you always say, you've just reached the Johnson home, and nobody's home right now. But if you leave a message, we'll return the call as soon as possible after the beep. Beep.
How is your acting experience when you were an Indian chief and all the rest? How has that informed your radio broadcasting, especially on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me?
Well, I think any time you do any – well, I was quite active in my high school drama department, for one thing. And I think that helped a lot. For one thing, you learn voice projection. You learn how to interpret copy, how to take it and read it and make sure you're getting a message across and not just reading words that mean nothing to anybody. And how to get along with a lot of good people in the industry. I've met a lot of people who just can never get along with somebody that, that they're working with. But you got to get along with everybody. Those are the basic things, I think.
What do you want to do in your next career?
I'll continue what I'm doing now, as long as I can.
Would you branch out anywhere?
It would depend on what I would be branching into. Right now, I'm very happy doing what I do. I have my office at NPR. I record things almost daily during the week for sending out to our stations. And then I do get, and I have been doing the program Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me in Chicago for a while. And maybe some things are in the future yet for me.
What about television, Carl?
I never thought about television for some reason. Never has been of any interest to me. I love radio. The pictures are better on the radio, I think.
They are. And you have, especially with an NPR audience, an audience that can create a lot of pictures.
Oh, yes.
Our guest has been Carl Casson. We thank you for being with us. It's been fun visiting with another veteran of radio.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
You betcha. And thank you at home for joining us here on Primetime Radio. We invite you to call our toll-free number with comments on our programs. That number is 1-800-424-9343. In Washington, D.C. only, 202-434-7608. We're online at aarp.org/radio with information about our guests and an archive of previous broadcasts. Primetime Radio is a production of AARP. Our producer is Angel Livas. Our assistant producer is John Allen. Our engineer today was Julio Gonzalez. Our camera technician, Andrew Portnoy. And audio post-production by Ben Pizzuto. I'm Mike Cuthbert in Washington.